OYOTU.com.
Sign Language with Bruce Williams.
Hi, and welcome to episode 144 of Sign Language. Over the last couple of weeks, I got a message from Steve Hope, who's another professional audio engineer based here in Sydney. Steve's got a very long history in TV primarily, but I think he's also had a bit of radio experience. And anyway, he sent me a link to a website called JaguarAudio.com. And I, for the life of me, cannot find the message that Steve originally sent me. I thought it was via Facebook Messenger, but I can't see it there. It's not via SMS, and it doesn't appear to be via email. So, Steve, my apologies. I don't know where the original message came from, but I do remember him suggesting that this website was maybe worthy of having a little bit of fun with, simply because these guys are hardcore audiophiles and they tend to be a little bit wanky. And so anyway, I went off to have a look at it, and it appears that they have a blog and they also have an online store. And certainly, you know, the online store has every kind of high-end audiophile home theater type product you could possibly imagine. This is not an online store you want to walk into without a big fat checkbook. Everything here is super expensive and super high-end. And I did go to have a look at the blog. And when you go to their blog, there's actually a welcome page for the blog. And I actually quite liked the introductory letter. Steve, I hope you forgive me for not giving these guys as much grief as you suggested. But anyway, I'll read it out.
We're passionate about audio, and judging by the fact that you're here, so are you. In our travels, our friendships, our studies, and our listening, we learn more about this discipline than we ever imagined possible. But there's much further to go. Yes, we are audiophiles, and we're not about to claim we're anything else. This is a hobby, a lifestyle, a discipline, an obsession, and anything else you wish to make it. You may imagine you could play the sax like Coltrane, the guitar like Hendrix, or sing like Jagger. But with audio, your art is recreating theirs. And in the end, it doesn't matter whether anyone else likes your sound more than you do. Around these parts, we favour boutique audio products over the popular brand name products typically found in electronics stores. Nothing wrong with a Sony amplifier or a pair of Infinity speakers. We're just more into gear built on a small scale by bootstrapped designers who you hear about on the forums or online magazines frequented by our sphere of audiophiles. At this moment, we're entering a golden age of audio, a convergence of matured digital processors, and the computer is well underway. Digital music files will reach 32-bit 384K sample rate and DSD 5.6 Apex within 5 years, and the internet and shrinking electronic devices are making us all into potential musicians, recording engineers, and DJs. Audio gear is better than ever before, and breakthroughs with nanomaterials and other new technologies keep coming. It follows that these elements will eventually combine to produce a new era of amazing recording artists, and we intend to be ready for it. We hope you find this to be a place where you can derive a lot of value in your own audio adventures, and we can learn from each other. Listen on. Darren Falkenbrock.
Interesting piece, and I absolutely agree that, you know, where things are headed, you know, in terms of technology, it is just a fantastic time to be alive. Glyn and I have been having a very similar discussion on Shutters Inc., the photography podcast that I do, where Glyn is, you know, saying almost on a weekly basis exactly the same thing regarding photography. We are just in this amazing boom time of amazing technological innovation. You know, some of the projects you're seeing on Kickstarter in the photography field are just amazing. You know, people just doing amazing things, you know, whether it's with, you know, little Arduino PCB boards or, you know, just all kinds of stuff, little, you know, remote controlled flash units and, you know, all the gadgetry, like, I mean, the whole drone industry that's, you know, exploded overnight almost. Yeah, there's so much innovation going on, and I agree with Darren here that the audio sphere is pretty much in the same boat at the moment. You know, there's so much great innovation going on. And I was going somewhere with that, and now I completely lost my train of thought. But anyway, I no doubt I will come back to it because I've got other things to talk about, and I'm sure that something down the track here is going to spark my interest. Oh, okay, yes. The very next thing I've got on my list of things to talk about was, in fact, a project that I saw. Now, it wasn't on Kickstarter. Yeah, it is on Kickstarter. And this is a... Well, they're calling it a new musical instrument. It looks like one of those electronic guitar keyboard type contraptions that we saw quite popularized in the late 80s. You know, a thing that you play like a keyboard, but you strung it around your neck like a guitar. This thing is kind of like that in that it's 18, 24 inches long with a bunch of touch pads on it. But what's unique about this particular device is that it can be played like any existing instrument. So you can use it as a drum controller. So you can, you know, tap away on it with your fingers and your thumbs, or even use mallets if that's what you wanted to do. And you could obviously, you know, map drum samples to various pads on this thing so that you could play it like a drum kit. But you can also play it like a keyboard, you know, as if it was a piano. You know, place your fingers in, you know, regular piano positioning and just play it like a keyboard. But you can also strum it and get the sound of strummed guitar strings or plucked guitar strings. In the video, they even had someone bowing it, so you could play it like a violin and have it sound like a violin. You just need to go and watch the video. It's an amazing looking project, and I hope they get it off the ground. You know, this project, as I'm recording this, still has 25 days to go on Kickstarter. Their initial target was for $75,000. They reached that in 6 hours, and they are now at $894,000 of backing. So it's fair to say this one's definitely going ahead. They call it the Artiphon Instrument 1. Very interesting. Have a look at the video. It'll certainly, if that doesn't convince you that we're in a golden age of, you know, creative invention, nothing will. It's just, I thought it was really cool. Anyway, moving on. I was going back through the show notes of the episodes of Sign Language that I did last year in my failed attempt to relaunch this podcast last year, and realized that the last of the episodes that I did last year was recorded just before I had the girls from GRL in the studio at the Australian Radio Network where I work, and that I had mentioned on that episode of the podcast that in the next episode I would, you know, talk about how that recording had gone. And of course, that was when the wheels fell off and I didn't get to record any more episodes of the podcast last year. And it completely slipped my mind, and it wouldn't have even surfaced now, except for the fact that I was browsing back through the show notes to see what things I talked about last year and happened to come across that particular mention. So I thought, well, okay, it's, you know, old history now. But yes, I had the girls from GRL in the studio, this must have been about July or August of last year, and they were lovely girls, and they weren't hard to look at, I'll be honest, and unfortunately, I don't know if you caught this on the interwebs, but one of the girls from the band ended up committing suicide only about 4 weeks after they were in the studio here in Sydney, which was very sad. To think that, you know, this girl had been struggling with depression and saw no better way out of it than to take her life, which is, you know, very unfortunate. But coming back to them being in the studio, the approach that I took was to set up a figure eight setup, and I'm trying to think what they had. I think it was one acoustic guitar and one mandolin, and then all five girls singing, or it may have been two acoustic guitars and mandolin. I can't remember exactly, but it was a lot of fun. And I do remember stuffing up of leaving one of the figure eights muted accidentally, which was really annoying. So I ended up with only one of the figure eight mics actually running during the recording. Thankfully, there was enough spill from the other vocal mics to make up for my mistake. But anyway, I'll throw that mix on the tail end of this podcast in case anyone wants to hear it. It was a good song, Ugly Heart. You might remember it. It was a very poppy. I mean, the produced version was really super produced, like massively produced, where this is just an acoustic performance. But yeah, it was interesting. Anyway, something else I came across this week, a mention on productionadvice.co.uk about the fact that YouTube is pretty much doing its thing to kill the loudness wars, which thankfully, you know, it seems to me that there is a groundswell of interest in the loudness wars, and it seems that, I don't know, maybe I'm just too close to it, but it seems to me that more and more people are talking about it, which means we're probably getting closer and closer to the end of it. This particular post seems to think that YouTube having taken action regarding loudness levels is a huge nail in the coffin for the loudness wars. And I'll just quickly read some of what's in this post. The post says, the title is YouTube just put the final nail in the loudness wars coffin.
This is huge. It may not look like much, but if you're involved in music production, recording, mixing, or mastering, this image could be the most important thing you'll see all year. What is it? It's the loudness output of a YouTube playlist as measured by the Meterplugs Lcast loudness meter. So what? Well, first, it's quiet. The loudness levels are quite low, especially by modern loudness war standards. Second, it's very consistent. More importantly than the low loudness, they're almost all playing at the same loudness. What does this mean? It means that YouTube has been using loudness normalization on their music videos, and they've been doing it since December last year. Everything plays at a similar loudness regardless of how it was mastered, and no one has noticed. Hear it for yourself. This playlist is composed almost entirely of current releases with a wide variety of loudness on CD, and some of them are really loud. So for example, at the more dynamic end of the spectrum, Mark Ronson and Bruno Mars' massive hit Uptown Funk measures -12 LUFS on CD, whereas Love Me Like You Do by Ellie Goulding is squashed up to -8 LUFS. And later in the playlist, Madonna's Living for Love clocks in at an eye-watering -7 LUFS. But on YouTube, all of them are being played back at a similar loudness of roughly -13 LUFS. And that's huge, because YouTube is the single largest online discovery source for music. More kids look for music on YouTube than on iTunes, TV, radio, or anywhere. This is where they hear new music for the first time, decide if they like it, and whether to share it with their friends. And YouTube just took loudness out of the equation.
There's more to that post, and the video's there if you want to go and check it out. So I'll have the link in the show notes. I thought that was very interesting that YouTube is the number one spot that people look for new music, or particularly young kids, because I know what Max is like. You know, he's 14. He just spends hours and hours watching YouTube. Like, he would much rather watch YouTube than watch TV. So, yeah, very interesting. And, you know, obviously we're all very much interested in having the loudness wars disappear forever, because I think, you know, no one benefits from it. Music listeners over the last 20 years have been horribly inconvenienced and shortchanged by it. The sooner people wake up to the fact that it's a lost cause, the better. So anyway, yeah, I thought that was interesting. Another video that I came across this week that intrigued me both for this podcast and for Shutters Inc. was a time-lapse video shot in the Hang Son Dung cave in Vietnam. And this cave is recognized as being the largest underground cavern in the world. They reckon you could build a 40-story skyscraper inside it. It's that big a space. Now, I initially went to look at this because I thought it was interesting for Shutters Inc., you know, from a photographic point of view. But it got me thinking as I was listening to, and unfortunately there was no audio recorded in the cave as part of this time lapse. It was just a piano backing track. But it got me thinking that wouldn't the acoustics in a space like that be absolutely amazing? Because your walls would be most likely limestone. And although limestone is not really, really solid, you know, it has certain porous properties. It is, for all intents and purposes, it's still rock, which means it's going to be fairly reflective. There are going to be no parallel surfaces inside that space whatsoever, which means that the sound is going to bounce very randomly. And the size of the space, yeah, depending on which part of the cavern you were in, I would imagine would give a really lush reverb, simply because there's no parallel surfaces, all the reflections should be completely randomized, which means you would get no comb filtering in the reverb tail due to there being standing waves, which would only occur between parallel walls, right? But to this point in time, I've not actually found any recording, you know, that was specifically designed to let you hear what the inside of this cave sounds like. But I thought it would be an interesting... Well, I'll put it on my bucket list of places I want to visit, but yeah, it'd be interesting to hear what a space like that would be like. And it got me thinking about, I don't know if you've ever heard this, a guy called Paul Horn, who was a flautist, and that is a person who plays a flute, got permission, I'm guessing this must have been back in the 70s or the 80s now, to go into the King's Chamber inside the Pyramid of Cheops, or was it Khufu? One of the two, after hours, and the after hours part was significant because part of him going inside with his flute was that he wanted to record inside, but he didn't want the fluorescent lights to be switched on because they hummed. So he got permission to go in after hours, and he recorded his flute, him playing his flute inside the King's Chamber of one of the two pyramids, and with the lights turned off, and he recorded it to a Nagra quarter-inch tape recorder. And the room, I don't remember the exact specs, but I know that it was like a square room, and I think the vertical height made it not a perfect cube. So it was a prism, but all sandstone. And the natural reverb time, like the RT60 time, and for those who aren't familiar with RT60, it basically means the time it takes for the reverb tail of an impulse to drop by 60 dB was something, I think it was north of 7 seconds. It was something like 7.2 or 7.3 seconds or something like that. It was a phenomenally long reverb tail and super lush. It was just magnificent. I'll dig out a couple of links. I know there's some stuff on YouTube that link to that, so I'll put that in the show notes for anyone that wants to check that out. I remember being pretty amazed by it at the time that I heard it. I heard it off CD. This was long before the internet. It would have been in the 90s that I originally heard it. So, yeah, something else for you to go and check out. Which brings us to the final part of this episode, which will be Rob Bettler's Epic Email Part 2. Now... Part two of Rob's email was called The Toy on Stage Effect, and it reads like this.
I've been playing around with three great toys. The first two are called AltaVerb and Speakerphone. These tools allow you to alter your audio files to make them sound as if they're coming out of an old phonograph, all the way to making them sound like they're coming from concert speakers at an auditorium.
I'll just jump in here, Rob, and say they are both what we would call in the trade convolution reverbs. That is, rather than being algorithmically based reverbs, you know, which generate reflections and create reverb based on an algorithm, they use an impulse, and generally the impulse is something like a balloon pop recorded in that particular acoustic space. And the idea is that you record a balloon pop is a great thing to use as the impulse because it is so short, it's sharp, it has almost instantaneous attack and almost instantaneous decay, which means that all you get is just the sound of the space with virtually none of the original signal still in there, other than the, you know, the sharp transient at the start. So the idea with a convolution reverb is that you set up a microphone in, let's say, for example, a church. Sorry, I will get back to your email, I promise. You set up a microphone in, let's say it was a church, and then you might decide that you're going to mic this balloon pop from 5 meters away, or maybe 10 meters away, whatever. And you record, and you pop your balloon. And so what happens is you get this really short, sharp transient, and then you get the sound of the acoustic space reacting to that short, sharp transient of the balloon pop. What you then do is you take that recording, you edit off the balloon pop at the very beginning, because generally that balloon pop will decay before the first reflections even start. So you end up with a WAV file that just has the room's response to this short, sharp transient. And then the way convolution reverbs work is that you load that WAV file as an impulse, and then you feed whatever signal it is that you want to add reverb to through the convolution reverb, and it maps the sonic fingerprint, if you like, of that reverb tail to the input signal that you're feeding through it, which might be a voice track or it might be a guitar part or whatever it is. And so what you get is the sound of your input source, your voice, your guitar, whatever, as though it was being played in that church, for this example, or, you know, King's Chamber of a pyramid, whatever, you know, at the same distance from the microphone. Of course, how much of the reverb you decide to mix in with your original signal will then allow you to control the wet and dry balance. But essentially, things like AltaVerb and Speakerphone are working on that principle. So when you load up in Speakerphone, say, the impulse of the inside of a car, and I know that it has them because we have Speakerphone in our library of plugins at work, they've essentially done the same thing. Recorded something like a balloon pop inside a car, and then all they've done is kept the response of the inside of the car without the balloon pop transient at the front of it. And you can then, you know, put your voiceover track through that impulse and get the sound of someone speaking inside a car, or whatever the, you know, the space, quote unquote, happens to be. Okay. Back to Rob's email. Sorry for the little sidetrack there.
I even downloaded their expansion packs for different theatres and ambiences. The second tool,
so really that should be the third tool,
is called Paul Stretch, which you used to have to download independently, but lo and behold, Audacity has it already built in. I truly never expected this tool could transform and infuse so much life into a classic TV series intro. Audio file is attached. Tell me if you can guess what series it comes from.
Sorry, Rob. No idea. Did not recognize it.
It turned a classic TV series intro into something so incredibly new, yet still eerie and interesting to listen to. For those who may not have used it, Paul Stretch allows for sound to be elongated without noticeable distortion, and the result oftentimes resembles a mix of whale songs with a disembodied chorus ethereal atmospheres. It really is a Pandora's box, as you can feed it trash on one side, aka Justin Bieber, and you get gold on the other side, as it became famous for a few years back.
And he's got a link. I have a feeling I remember what that was about, but I'll include that link in the show notes.
It really is a lot of fun to play with, this stretching toy plug-in. Disclaimer, I hesitated putting the words play, toy, plug, and stretch in the same sentence, but there is the name of the plug-in anyways, no pun intended. Despite all of the discovery and amazement, the same thing happened as in the past. The same thing used to happen to me when I was a toddler or a teenager. As a toddler, I would endlessly nag my parents to buy me a toy, only to play with it for a while, then abandon it and completely forget about it. As a teen, I used to yearn for a book, save money for months, only to forget about it after buying it. The same has happened to me with these plug-ins. My low attention span, mixed with the toy on stage effect, is perhaps a form of OCD. The problem with AltaVerb, Speakerphone, and Pole Stretch is not the tools themselves, but the user. In this case, me. Why? Because I'm the one that puts the new toy on an empty stage, turns on the reflectors, and as the limelight shines the brightest, I, the only member of the audience, falls asleep. The problem with the toy on stage effect is that people like me often let the effect take the stage, and then we become very bored with it. Truth is, the tool should never take the stage. The stage belongs to the project that follows a creative idea. Despite the fact that the creators of the plugin were possibly fascinated by it, the plugin cannot replace the user's creativity, or else it becomes just a glorified gimmick. My problem was, and sometimes still is, that I was aimlessly using a tool without a specific purpose. If I'm out of creativity, I'm on my own, and I do not expect anybody to help me, because it's like expecting someone to think for me. I instead asked myself, point blank, what am I doing here? Disappointingly, I failed to come up with a satisfying answer at that moment. After a few days of thinking about that question, my best answer was having fun with the sound design project. Yes, I could have come up with far fancier answers, but I just wanted to be direct and honest. Since I clearly was having fun before the toy on stage effect hit me with boredom, I came to the conclusion I lacked a purpose slash project slash methodology. I then started searching for some form of guidelines to make my fun last longer. After a few hounded jumps on Google, I finally gave up. Then I decided to break it down to the basics and look for the purest, most honest principles of not only audio design, but just design itself. I then found 10 masterful rules by the founding father of design, Dieter Rams. Now, just to be clear, Rams' 10 rules of industrial design originally do not apply to audio design, but I argue there are parallels that can be adapted to audio.
Now, I'm not going to read all of this out. I'll include all of what Rob's written here in the show notes for anyone that wants to read it, along with the links that he's included. Just quickly, the 10 rules of audio, the 10 rules of design, according to Dieter Rams, are: it should be 1, innovative; 2, make a product useful; 3, be aesthetic; 4, make the product understandable; 5, be unobtrusive; 6, be honest; 7, be long-lasting; 8, be thorough down to the last detail; 9, be environmentally friendly; and 10, use as little design as possible. Now, all of Rob's musings on how each of those points can be related to audio will be in the show notes for anyone that wants to have a read. And Rob finished off this section of his email with, "Obviously, these notes on audio are just a draft, and I intend to develop them into more carefully adapted 10 rules to audio design. I would, however, be very interested in hearing disagreement from you and your audience, as disagreement and feedback is often what helps us learn." Well, Rob, I've got to say, the first one, can it be adapted to audio? Yes, hardware, software, audio technology is constantly evolving. There's no reason to become swamped or declare it complete. Absolutely agree with that, 100%. As I said, at the beginning of this episode, some of the things that we're seeing, like just projects on Kickstarter, not only in the audio sphere, but in the photographic sphere, just suggest that, no, how could you ever call anything complete? The further we go down this path of technological and scientific inquiry, the more there is to discover, the more there is to invent, the more there is to create. I always think back to the famous quote by Bill Gates in 1982. Who would ever want more than, what was it, 64 kilobytes of RAM, I think was the quote. It's like, this was Bill Gates. I mean, if ever there was a guy who should have known better, you know, in 1982, said, who will ever need more than 64 kilobytes of memory? And I was like, what? How could someone who had his finger on the pulse of everything that was happening in computing be so off the mark? Yeah, how could he not see where things were going? So, yeah, you know, I don't believe we can ever call any line of, you know, technological development complete. I don't think we're ever going to reach a point of completeness, because new technology always breeds more new technology. You know, every advance leads to some other advance, which just keeps on opening up completely new ideas, you know. So in terms of these other points that you've raised, Rob, I'll just quickly look at a couple of them. Making a product understandable, well, certainly that goes without saying, certainly in my line of work, you know, my job is to convey the message of an advertiser to an audience so that the audience understands what the client has to offer, how they can get to it, you know, and what the benefits of that product are to them, you know. So, you know, making it understandable, certainly for my line of work, absolutely critical. So no argument there. Unobtrusive, again, I would agree with that, you know. In terms of radio commercials, we don't want commercials to be obtrusive, although they are. I think we all agree on that. Most of us would rather hear radio without commercials if we had a choice. Is honest? Yep, definitely. Definitely. And I think the same parallels could be drawn for music as well. You know, it should be unobtrusive. It should be honest. Long lasting? Well, yeah, that comes down to what the audio project is in question. A commercial that I make that advertises a sale that's happening this weekend, that's not going to be long-lasting. It's got a life cycle of 7 days at most. But a song, you know, song could last 50 years, 100 years, who knows. Thorough down to the last detail, absolutely. I think that's, you know, absolutely justifiable. And I think if you listen to any commercial that has won an award, you know, at the highest levels, you know, like the New York Radio Festivals or, you know, the Mobius Awards or any of those types of things, you know, when you hear those commercials that have won international acclaim and you listen to them, you know, with a really focused ear, you can hear that every single sound that made up that commercial was finessed right the way through the process, you know, from the voiceover to the sound effects that were chosen, to how those sound effects were edited and mixed in with the voiceover, to the music that was chosen, whether it was scored specifically for a commercial or whether it was production music, and the way it was mixed in. You know, when you hear an award-winning commercial, you recognize that every single aspect of what made that commercial was, you know, attention to detail was paid all the way through. So definitely agree with that. Environmentally friendly, yeah, I'm not sure really how that, yeah, Rob did say no to that one. As little design as possible, yeah, I'd go along with that. There's a great quote by Sir George Martin referring to the Beatles. And I think this must have been later in their career when they had access to more tracks of tape, you know, when they were working on 8-track and 16-track tape. And he said that when he came to the mixing process, he would listen to everything that had been recorded, and his approach to the mix was, what is the least number of these tracks that I can put into the mix and convey the message? And anything beyond that got left out. You know, his whole approach was, what's the bare minimum, that we can use and get this song to work. And I thought, wow, that's epic. Anyway, so the full list of Rob's points and thoughts there will be in the show notes for anyone that wants to check that stuff out. There's a couple more things that I wanted to mention before I closed off. One, I don't even remember what the reason was, but yesterday I happened to download the last episode of Sign Language, and I was listening to it in my production studio at work, and it sounded awful. It was hideous. I could hear the gate cutting in and out, trying to get rid of the noise of the PC, which is underneath my desk here. And originally, as I was listening to it, I was thinking, my God, what's that? What's all that encoding noise? Did I accidentally encode this at like 64 kilobit or something? And then I thought to myself, no, I deliberately set the encoding rate on this episode even higher than normal because of the Francis Dunnery song that was on the end of it. And I encoded it at 256. And of course, then it occurred to me, oh, no, it's not the encoding, it's that gate. And so as I was sitting down to record this evening, I mucked around with the positioning of my R84 and realized that if I turn it to the angle that I've now got it on, it actually does a much better job of rejecting the noise of the PC, which is obviously coming from an angle which is 90 degrees to the angle that the mic is currently facing, because the sides of the mic reject sound because it's a figure eight. So I'll just have to be very careful in future to make sure I have the R84 pointed in this direction, where that PC noise in the background is far less offensive. So my apologies for last week's episode. I didn't realize how bad it sounded. Yeah, that's a worry. And the final thing that I want to mention briefly, Rowan Matthews, you'll be very happy to know that I have just bought and executed my very first attempt at an electronics project. It was just a little sound meter project kit that I picked up at JCAR. And when I say sound meter, I thought I was getting like a, you know, sound pressure level meter. But no, it's actually just like a single channel peak program meter of 10 LEDs. Very basic. Half a dozen resistors, couple of capacitors, couple of diodes, one transformer, one IC, and was there something else? A couple of other bits and pieces. Anyway, fairly basic kit. PCB was only about 10 centimeters long and about 3 centimeters wide, so it was pretty small. But I was pretty impressed with myself. It was my first go at ever working with, you know, soldering components to a PCB. And I nailed it on the first attempt. I didn't have to desolder any of the components and try a second time. I got them all right. Managed not to get my solder spilling across tracks and, you know, having to etch gaps in the solder or anything like that. So I was pretty impressed with myself. Very basic project. Not quite ready to tackle a seventh circle audio mic preamp just yet, but we'll work up to that. So I thought you'd be impressed to hear that. So if I get some time, I'll take a photo of the completed project and include it in the show notes. And I think that will do it for this fortnight. Any questions, comments, feedback, please drop me an email or flick me a message on Facebook or hit me on Twitter at audio2u. Email studio@audio2u.com. And until I speak with you next, take care.
Sign Language.
Another audio2u.com quality podcast. For previous episodes, check out
signlanguagepodcast.com
or search the iTunes Music Store. For questions, comments, and feedback, email studio@audio2u.com.
Crazy, maybe I'm a fool, maybe I don't know how to love, but maybe I do. Maybe you know more than me, but this much is true. There's a little heart and brain of mine, say we're through with you.
And I wonder, does it blow your mind that I'm leaving you far behind? I wonder, does it stop your heart to know you're not my sunshine anymore?
Okay, you're pretty, your face is a work of art. Your smile can light up New York City after dark. Okay, your cover boy pretty, stamped with a beauty mark. It's such a pity a boy so pretty with an ugly heart.
Baby, you'll get married and she will kiss your feet. While I give all my rights away, I won't lose no sleep. Maybe on your honeymoon, you'll think of me. But if you don't, won't shed a tear, yeah, I can guarantee.
And I wonder, does it blow your mind that I'm leaving you far behind? I wonder, does it stop your heart to know you're not my sunshine?
Smile can light up New York City after dark. Okay, your cover boy pretty, stamped with a beauty mark. It's such a pity a boy so pretty. Your smile can probably light up New York after dark. Okay, your cover boy pretty, stamped with a beauty mark. But it's such a pity, a boy so pretty.
Such a pity a boy so pretty.
It's such a pity a boy so pretty.
So pretty, so pretty.